Hey there, a couple quick clarifications before we get started here. Right off the bat, my guest today, I'm still doing Zoom calls for the episodes. I'm doing long distance interviews and also COVID. But I think she has a fan going in her apartment because it's also summer and we're in the middle of a heat wave. And I didn't hear this fan until we were well past the midway point of recording the episode. Otherwise, I probably would have asked her to turn it off. But I heard this buzzing kind of going on in the background. And I was like, where is that coming from? Is that coming from my computer? Is that coming from? And then I noticed it was coming out of the speakers. And I thought, oh, she's probably got like an air conditioner on or something. That is not her fault. That's not Chris's fault over at Marmalade Music, who's mixing and mastering the episode. That's on me. I'm the producer of the show. I'm supposed to catch stuff like that, and I didn't. So there's a little hum. There's a little buzz under the audio today. So that's the first thing. Second thing, I'm going to be using the phrase BIPOC a lot on this episode. That's kind of a new terminology that you've probably seen floating around the interwebs, but in case you're unfamiliar, BIPOC refers to Black Indigenous People of Color community. So that's what that little anagram is. Like I said, kind of a new thing, but we use the term a lot. Also, I talk about this paper that was sort of issued by the BIPOC theater artist community called The Ground We Stand On or We See You. And I refer to it several times as a manifesto of sorts or like a proclamation. I don't know if those are the correct terms to be using for it. That's just what I'm calling it because that seems to be the most correct. And I also, when I'm referencing it, sometimes use the pronouns like I say like we or like us. And I'm not saying that to include myself in the BIPOC community, not that I don't align with the values and the demands in the ground we stand on, but I'm saying that as like, I'll say like, in this, it's saying that we want this. And I'm referring to the authors and the co-signers of that manifesto. So that's a little clarification on that. Last clarification, my guest today at the very end of the episode refers to a play that was recently on Broadway, and she calls it Straight Play, and I believe that she was intending to refer to the play Slave Play by Jeremy O'Harris. I think that's everything I need to clarify at the top here. Yeah, okay, here we go. Enjoy the episode. Clutching, knee-jerk response white theater professionals like myself tend to have whenever our BIPOC colleagues suggest that we might still have issues with inclusivity and representation. Issues with diversity in the American theater? Surely you jest. Why, we're the most inclusive industry in the world. We've been home to white, gay, male authors and actors since the early 20th century. And they've been allowed to be out since at least the late 70s. We've broken down barriers around gender norms with shows like La Cage aux Folles and Kinky Boots. We've platformed BIPOC stories like Fences, The Color Purple, Ragtime, Aida, and more recently, Hamilton and In the Heights. We even let Asian Americans get in on the fun every once in a while with shows like Miss Saigon and Allegiance. Trouble with inclusivity? We let Harvey Fierstein sing, for God's sakes. That's about as inclusive as it gets. If this sounds anything like your pearl-clutching, knee-jerk response, you could be forgiven. After all, if you had to pick one historically racist American institution to crusade against, you could certainly find much worse offenders than the theater. But I can't help but feel, after the conversation I recently had with my friend LaToya, that maybe an industry that prides itself on its inclusivity and progressiveness should be leading the charge on diversity and inclusion and not defaulting to defensiveness and old habits when challenged to try harder to do better. Because it would really be a shame if we just returned to business as usual when theaters eventually decide it's safe to reopen. It would also be disappointing if we did what we so commonly do and scheduled a season of diverse shows to performatively placate our BIPOC colleagues, only to return to our typically whitewashed programming shortly thereafter. It seems to me that we have an opportunity right now that we haven't had in a very long time. Namely, we have time. Time to truly sit and reflect and evaluate the ways in which our old habits and routines were falling short and how we can do better moving forward. Time to consider the kinds of stories we tell and who gets to craft those stories. Time to commit to long overdue practices and policies that will lovingly and boldly help not only our industry, but our audiences as well become accustomed to the more inclusive and more diversified future of theater. It seems like there's a tendency, when people are asking for grand, sweeping change, to tell those people that they need to learn to wait, to be patient, and to acknowledge the little victories. There's a tendency to feel like big changes take time and happen bit by bit over long periods. And that's understandable. But it seems to me that a field of artists who pride themselves on their progressive values should be comfortable leading the charge to push that slow process along a little faster and to constantly strive for better and more exciting methods of executing their craft. It's time for white theater artists to mean what they say and to truly commit to moving boldly forward. Because, and I mean this, if not now, then when? From a Blankenfort recording studio in my one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my very good friend, LaToya Cameron, about her take on diversity and representation in theater. Speaking of this year, what are you doing with all of your free time? Also, do you like this ginormous thing that I keep going behind? This is this is my new microphone windscreen that is, it's larger than my head, so I can disappear behind it so that you can't see me. You might have heard Carlton and I talking about it on his episode at the beginning, because I was like, what do you think of this giant thing? And he was like, yeah, it's pretty insane.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of like the man behind the microphone. Who's the man behind the microphone?
Yeah, just mystery person here. Yeah. For all you know, it's not even me. But what are you doing with all of your free time? Because you're an actor who works all the goddamn time, and actors aren't doing anything now. So, I mean, have you, like, has there been any part of you that's been like, a little bit like, hooray for the free time. Like, I can do some writing, or I can do some, like, what have you been doing?
I was at first. I was like, oh, okay. Like, this is a time where I can actually start creating. And I have tons of screenplays that I want to write. So I started writing one, did not get very far. And then I was like, oh, I've been wanting to, like, teach myself how to play the guitar better. I kind of know the basics, but even the basics, I really don't know. I just play. But I was like, I can learn how to actually play it and actually become a good guitarist. Did that for maybe a week, and then I did not want to do that. And then it just kind of slowly, as time kept going by, I just felt myself surrender to the reality of what we're actually in. This, it feels like the world is saying stop. And pause and reassess right now what you've been doing, how you have been spending your time. Because I am a busy body. Like, if I can, I'm always doing everything from the crack of dawn to the, you know, into the latest of early mornings. Like, I'm always doing something, and it's burning me out, and it's damaged relationships. And that's something that I wasn't aware of until I actually had to really start to think about how I was spending that time. So in the bigger picture of things, once when I kind of was like, this is not what I'm supposed to be doing, I just stopped and had to really dive into what stuff is important to me. And that is my relationships with my friends, my relationships with my family, my relationship with my boyfriend and my dog, and with myself. So that's kind of been like, theater and creativity have happened in different ways, but right now it's kind of been pushed to a different viewpoint for me right now, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like, I remember seeing early on when this was happening, like, lots of memes coming out that was just like, kind of like, hey, I don't know who needs to hear this, but like, reminder, you don't need to write the great American novel while this quarantine's going on. Like, it's enough to just kind of take care of yourself and just sort of get through it. You don't need to like utilize this free time to revolutionize your, you know, creative pursuits. And that's not to say anything against people who maybe have been very active during this time and have, but like, but just the idea that like, you don't need to shame yourself into like feeling an urgency around doing this or that. It's certainly a year to stop and take stock of what's really important and maybe some important work that's been getting neglected. Because I think that's a big thing that happens to us theater actors and us actors in general, is that it's just sort of a norm of our lives that we regularly miss big events, you know, like weddings and funerals and all manner of things, family reunions and things that I can't tell you how many weddings and family reunions I was the only person in my extended family who wasn't there because I was doing some show, you know.
Right.
And the kind of the odd irony of this free time is that it's still like hard to schedule time to gather with people because it's still like uncertain about, should I be, like, Mary and I, when this first happened, we were like, should we go home to Utah? Should we go see our families? And then it was like, well, that might not be responsible or smart or safe of us to like take what we don't know if we have or not to Utah, you know?
Right.
And, but yeah, definitely. I hear you on that stopping to take stock, especially when it's like, oh, cool, I'm going to write my screenplay or I'm going to write my play. And then America's like, not only pandemic, but also, reminder, we're still doing all this race stuff. reminder, guys, we're not done with that and haven't been. And here,
well, that was 400 years ago.
Here's a great opportunity for us to stop and take stock of some important shit. So before we get into that, Let's go back in the simpler time before 2020, before the pandemic, and before we had time to take stock and look around. And let's just look at kind of your history and your career, brief history of your involvement with the theater and with the arts and kind of how you got to here.
Yeah. I mean, my first love was music, actually. I wanted to be a singer. And I remember my parents, they were like, God, please no. Because my dad, he, when I was very, very little, he was in a band. He was a singer and writer. And they like went out to California, tried to do the whole music business thing. He had a small amount of success, but then stuff happened, you know, life, children, financial issues, of being young and wanting to be an artist, you know, kind of takes you back home when you don't have much. So we came back, my family came back to Utah. My dad kind of focused other ways to make means end. But I was drawn into music at a very young age. And then my dad actually is an actor too. He does more film work than any stage work. And I remember sitting in the front room watching my parents go back and forth, like practicing lines and stuff. And I was intrigued by it because I was like, what is this? This is so weird. But I was just watching in amazement of what they were doing. And I grew up very shy and kind of to myself. And one day in junior high, my math teacher, she actually taught the drama class. And I asked her if I could join her class. And she looked at me. Actually, I think she like looked around seeing who actually said that. And then it was me. And she was like, you. And I said, yeah, I want to try. And she had to think about it. She was like, you don't really, you know, do much. Did you take the speech and drama class and stuff? And I said, no. She goes, well, you need to take that before you can take this drama class. And I was just like, I will fake cry for you right now, which is the weirdest thing. And she was like, please don't do that. Like,
this is what you said?
Yeah, I really said that to her. I've been practicing at home, like holding open my eyes and be like, I can cry.
I can do it right now. I swear to God.
I'm already doing it right now.
I am an emotionally vulnerable teenager. I can cry at the drop of a hat. I promise.
Trust me. Say no and you'll see what happens.
Yeah.
But she was like, please just don't do that and let me think about it. So maybe like a couple weeks later, she came up to me and she goes, yeah, I'm going to like, let's try. I'm going to give you a shot. So I said, okay. Then the next year she actually, I think was fired for certain things. Great teacher though. But also like, I think some stuff went down. So there was
new drama
teacher. I know. I was like, what?
Scandal.
I know, scandal in Kaysville, Utah. Mm-hmm. But my new drama teacher, Mrs. Clark, she gave us all the girls St. Joan monologue by Bernard Shaw, and gave the boys Glass Menagerie monologue. And I didn't know what I was doing. I probably should have taken that speech and drama class, but whatever. And somehow I ended up on stage and started speaking the text. And ever since then, like, it taught me how to hear my voice for the first time. And I remember being so shaken by it that I was like, wow, that's my voice. That was the moment I was like, I gotta keep doing this. I gotta keep doing this. And I have ever since. So.
And to great effect. I love that you went from the pursuit of a risky and unstable career as a singer to the much more stable choice and secure choice of being an actor.
You know, like you do.
But yeah, that's great. I love that. I'd never heard that story. So that's really lovely to hear. I like hearing how people get into it or discover it. Let's kind of jump into as you see it, or as you've been examining it over the past few months, sort of the outlying or the outline of the manifesto, let's call it, of the ground we stand on, and sort of this mission statement for white theater practitioners and regional theaters, and also a little bit of kind of like your personal experience with that, like ways in which as a union actor and as an actor who's worked in houses all over the country, you feel like perhaps you've been either tokenized or maybe taken advantage of or not listened to or not heard, and how that relates to this push for, you know, while we're in this moment where theaters are not producing, well, where responsible theaters are not producing, that we have an opportunity to sort of evaluate our old practices and customs and maybe do some restructuring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I personally, this time has been overdue, I think. It's been past time for this to finally be taken seriously. I know this is not the first conversation that not only this higher up group of BIPOC artists But I know other artists in our own ways have spoke about diversity and inclusion for a long time. And
yeah.
And inclusivity and visibility. I mean, I can remember as far back even in college, you know, even I think in high school, you know, I felt like theater is a place that tells all of us to come and join. If you feel like you're not a part of whatever, come be a part of this. You're welcome. Anyone, you can, it doesn't matter what you look like. It doesn't matter about your orientation. It doesn't matter about whatever, like come and we're gonna play, we're gonna create.
Right.
Anyone can be a part of that, right?
Right. We're this band of outcasts, we're this band of misfits.
Right.
We're like whoever you are, whatever your thing is, you're welcome here. You know, we are the bastion for LGBT youth and the yeah, exactly. Diversity is welcome here. This is what
yes.
the arts are about, inclusivity and representation. I mean, Mary and I are rewatching the first season of Glee right now because Glee came up in our conscience because it's just weird the sort of fallout that show has had. But like
right.
the whole theme of the show is that like all the weird kids and the popular ones, whoever you are, you can find acceptance in this
right.
in this group. Yeah.
I mean, that's like most people who I would think, I guess I can't generalize, not most people, but I can speak from my experience, like being in the theater as, you know, the only Black girl in the theater department in high school or in the advanced theater class, it was the place that I felt like I could just kind of be and be seen
mm-hmm.
and be accepted. But of course, being young and all of us being privy to our experience in the systematic racism that we're born into, it does influence how we even view the theater, how we have filters on about like, yeah, you can come hang out, but you got to look like this, 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 this. You got to be like this, 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 this. And that's something you don't see coming when you're like young and fresh, when you're like, come on, this is where I'm supposed to come and be. You're a troubadour, you know? Yeah, just the realization of that as I got older is disheartening, even more so now. So, like, I feel like it feels so brand new, but it feels so not to me. And I feel like for a lot of people, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Are there specific ways that, and it's okay if there's not, like sometimes when I ask questions like this, I understand that I'm putting people on the spot and it's like, it's fine if you can't think of a specific example. Doesn't mean that it's like, haha, if you can't name something off the top of your head, but like, are there specific examples of like, that you can think of where coming into this industry as an adult and as a professional, where you were surprised by there was an expectation of me to behave or look a certain way. And I didn't think that that's what theater was. I didn't think that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I feel like I remember going in college because they mentioned about education in their demands. And I was like, yes, because I feel like that's where a lot of, at least for me, where a lot of my ideas, I wanted to stretch beyond what I was told that I could play. Cause like, you know, the world tells you that you can't be Joan of Arc because I wasn't white. So I can't be Joan of Arc, but I was like, well, I want to play Joan of Arc and I want to do whatever I want. I'm a rebel, I guess, whatever. But I remember specifically in college where I would audition for anything, everything. And I remember auditioning for, as stupid as it sounds, Seussical, the musical. And I knew, of course, the Sarah Kangaroo traditionally is played by and written for a Black woman to sing.
Right.
And I was like, well, I know I can already do that. I want to stretch myself and see if I can play these other characters. And specifically, I wanted to play Gertrude.
Oh, you'd be a great Gertrude.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Yeah.
I was like, this would be a fun stretch for me, especially at my like in an educational setting.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, I wore all pink. I picked like a high pitched song. I nasaled all the things, very Gertrude. And they're like, oh, okay. And I got called back for all three of those roles, including the Sour Kangaroo. And I was like, that's fine. You know, whatever. sang it. I felt like I did like a good job and left. And I was like, all right, cool. And of course I got the Sour Kangaroo.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay. So then even in the rehearsal process, it was like, I was told on tons of times that I wasn't soulful enough, that I need to like act more soulful, do more riffing, do all these things. And I was just like, really? Like, what if I want to interpret this character completely different that y'all don't even know what's coming, but you're going to pigeonhole me into playing this stereotype of this. She's a kangaroo, for hell's sake. You
it's
know,
like, hey guys, first of all, it's a fucking kangaroo.
Right, second,
second of all, I'm going to just venture a guess that your well-meaning director of the show was probably white.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And, oh God.
It was, and it was weird when they tried to show me how to do it. Like I didn't know how to.
No.
I was looked in like, oh yes. I'm like, I remember actually being like, well, what do you mean by soulful?
Oh.
And our music director was like, and she was an opera singer, and she was like this, and she proceeded to do operatic riffs.
Oh.
And I was like, that's soulful.
It's like, it's pinching my fragile white soul into a ball. Like, it's making me just cringe, and my white guilt alarms are blaring, and I'm like, ooh, it's,
yeah.
And like, I think that in the brain of a typical white theater practitioner, the knee-jerk response is to be like, hey, look, you got cast and you got a great role and you got to like sing on stage and like sing this really cool song and like, you, like, come on, like be grateful that you got to perform and like you were included and you weren't like excluded from the play because of your race, you know, like you got to play. But God, like, when you outline the story like that, it's like, do you see the issue here, though,
yeah,
that it's still, you can play, but we have pre-designated spaces for you that we need you to come and fill. We have pre-designed archetypes that we need you to come and do over and over and over again from now until the end of your career. And
yeah,
please and thank you.
And it's like, I have to be great. Like that whole grateful thing. I'm not going to lie. Like my whole perspective in the theater, I feel like has shifted, and I don't know when it kind of clipped, like switched over for me, but I'm like, no, I feel like most artists that I've encountered are grateful. Like we're grateful that we get to tell stories. Mm-hmm. We're grateful that we get to be in the room. We're grateful that we get to even be a part of this career. Like, I've told people, I'm like, yes, we're grateful. And also being treated like you are less than, I'm not going to continue to make that okay.
Yeah.
I'm not going to continue to pretend to be grateful for you to treat me like shit, to be disrespected. And, you know, just to be like, I'm just like, I'm not going to be privy to that kind of behavior of abuse and manipulation anymore.
Yeah.
And like, I'm not going to do that. And people are just like, I'm just so grateful for this job. I'm like, well, you worked for this job. They should be grateful that you showed up.
They should be grateful that you spent your whole life cultivating this craft so that you could show up and do a kick-ass job for them and entertain their audiences. And look, yeah, I am grateful. This is like when people talk about like, actors who are only in it for the money, like theaters that don't pay very well. And they're like, well, we just don't want to attract the kind of actors that are only doing it for the money. It's like, first of all, I'm not doing this for the money. Cause if I wanted to go out, if I was looking for a lucrative career, I would not pick theater actor, you know, like that's,
right.
I'm not in this for the money. I am here because I fucking love this. And because I feel like I can't do anything else. I feel like my life force is tied to this. But that being said, I do need to pay my bills. So you can fuck all the way off with that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I'm like, no. Like I do my work. I show up on time, focused, giving it my all, ready to take notes. Like, don't patronize me. Don't treat me like I'm a child. Yeah. You know, it's something that like I cannot handle anymore. And like, especially like, well, are you grateful they're doing Big River again? Where you can have, I'm like, no, I ain't doing that shit. Like, no, I'm not grateful for that. Do better.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I liked outlined. I don't know if it was outlined specifically in that like one page manifesto of The Ground We Stand On, which also I think I'm going to talk about that at the beginning, but like it is this kind of this sort of movement for better representation and better inclusivity in theater and not just kind of tokenized like performative representation.
Right.
But one of the things that I saw that I really liked was like cast more, you know, have more diverse casts and include more BIPOC performers and designers and producers, and not just in your one token show per season that's like Big River or Aida or like your one show that you know requires you to do it. Like, do it as often as possible. Do it so often so that it just becomes, so that we become part of the normalized fabric of this art form. And like you said, God, well, like long overdue, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's not even, it's that. And also it's just like, we're talented. I've said this before and to other people that we've been putting in the work, we have been showing up, and I feel like on the opposite side of the table, they haven't done the work and they haven't been showing up. They have been pushing it back to wait for the right time, whatever that means, to finally do a season where they can add inclusivity. I mean, I saw it here a couple of years ago when they're like, we're going to do Othello and we're going to do Big River and we're going to have a diverse season, you know, like everybody jumped on that Hamilton bandwagon and was like, we could do that. And I was like, nah, like, and everyone, I remember it was that whole thing, aren't you so grateful that's happening? And I was like, no. And everyone was like, what? Oh, blasphemy. Don't ever say no in the theater, blah, blah, blah. Be grateful. And I was like, I'll be grateful when I see that it's consistent. I will be grateful when I start seeing that it is not something that is a trend, and that is not tokenized, and that it's not a check mark on a box for people to go, see, look, we did this one season where we had a bunch of diversity, and then the next season goes back to whitewashing.
Yeah.
See that. I saw it right after those seasons. There's tons of seasons across the country doing diverse seasons with diverse casting, and then the next season it was back to normal.
Yeah, it kind of becomes a trend, and it kind of becomes like here's your bone, like haha, there you go. Like it's very it's very patronizing and
yes,
yeah.
It just needs to stop, and they pat themselves on the back like they did a good job.
I think that I wonder if part of the issue is that like, we as white theater practitioners really just don't. We just don't know, like that. It's like we really think that is doing a good job. You know, we think that we are doing a good job. We think like no, but like we're doing these shows. We're putting like, you know what I mean? And then when we see one of the demands that I talked about this in my notes that I sent you, but one of the demands that I see where it says like, we want 50% representation in every single production. My knee-jerk response to that is like, well, what if you're in an area where there's not like a 50% demographic breakdown? Like, that's just not fair to the actors showing up to the audition. You can't, like, acting's hard. Rejection is a big part of acting. Like, being told no is a big part of it. You can't just like demand to be cast in a show. Like, not getting cast is just part of the equitable practice of being a professional actor. But then I have to stop and stop myself and think, yes, but Austin, isn't it possible that you've been operating in this highly competitive industry for years with an advantage you didn't even know or were aware of? And like, this is just part of an effort to normalize more equitable casting practices. And like, it's not about like, taking away a role that was rightfully yours, or that it's just about the fact that there's ways that it's already not operating on a fair basis that I'm not even aware of. And I'm thinking like, well, hold on, you're trying to make it unfair, you know? And it's like, well, it already is unfair, you know? I don't know. Talk about that a little bit, about casting, like demands and.
Well, I think that I don't see why it's not possible to have 50%. Like our country we are flooded with diverse talent everywhere. And I feel like it goes back, honestly, for me, education. A lot of the BIPOC community do not have access to the opportunities of getting great training in the theater because of their family situation. They might not have the finances that they need for education. They might not have, all the assistance that might not be able, they might not be able to find that, you know? And a lot of times, like even some of the great actors I've worked with here in Utah never went to school for acting. They kind of had to learn by going to the auditions, by being in shows to understand what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I feel like the theater needs to allow that to happen. Not allow, it needs to happen. Because honestly, like you look at a lot of programs nowadays, and in the past, that a lot of those prestigious programs have a lot of white students.
Yeah.
And sometimes the majority of them are white students.
Oh, yeah.
And not one BIPOC person is in there.
Yeah.
And it goes back to money. And if they don't have, we don't have the money in the BIPOC community to be able to have that kind of education, how are we going to be able to get through those doors? How are we going to be able to, you know, so there needs to be more of an outreach and more education given to the BIPOC community so they can show up to those auditions to kick ass. From the meantime, there is a floodgate of that kind of that talent. And I still feel like people who are behind the table, which are most white people, have strategically pushed BIPOC people out of the limelight, out of the room.
Yeah, and it's so bizarre because it really, I mean, to anyone who's ever gone and seen even one of those tokenizing shows like Big River or like, you know, like Ragtime or what, you know, like it's not a question of lack of talent, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, again, we're watching Glee right now. And like one of the most, that show is ridiculous, first of all. The writing on that show is insane and ridiculous. But like one of the most ridiculous things on the entire show is the way that they kind of like make a joke out of the fact that Mercedes always wants the lead solo and they can't give it to her unless it's like a traditionally black solo. And I'm just right. Like, but she is the best singer on the show. And they just kind of always like make fun of her. Like she'll be like, well, how come I can't sing the show solo? And Mr. Schuster will be like, well, because Mercedes, we don't have time to rearrange the whole song for you. Rachel's going to sing it. You know, and it's like, even just that statement that we would have to like rearrange the song to make it like a gospel song or make it like
right.
More of a black arrangement for you, Mercedes. But it they just sort of like write in these excuses as to why Mercedes is not the star of the show. And instead Lea Michele, who is very talented, is instead the star of the show. But it's like it's almost like they were aware that they had this issue of like, well, the most talented person in our cast is gonna be kind of a supporting character, and we have to like right reasons as to why that is. Instead of just acknowledging the fact that like there's some old good old fashioned like bullshit racism going on.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like just let the talent be.
Yeah.
You know? And it's funny because I watched maybe like the first two seasons of Glee and then I lost interest, but to each their own.
Right.
Glee on. But I remember just being like, you can't, like, she's so good that no matter what you did, you couldn't hide how good she was.
Right.
Like, you just couldn't. So why didn't they just let her be the lead in the show?
Right.
You know, just let, like, it's, there's no excuse.
Yeah, the show had to constantly kind of like insecurely and self-consciously apologize for having her not be a more prominent character. And like they like almost like they were aware of the problem and they were like, we're going to, don't worry, every like five episodes, she's going to sing a kick-ass solo and it's going to like be really awesome. So don't worry. But like, it's kind of like in the last Star Wars movie when they cut cut that character out that was in the eighth one. What's her name? Rose. They cut Rose out and they sort of like wrote in all these excuses as to why she couldn't be on the main mission with the main characters. And they were like, see, she would go, but she has to stay back and help Leia. So it's not our fault that she's not in the movie. It's the story's fault. Like just like insecurely apologizing for
it's the story's fault. Like, yeah. Don't you write the stories?
You're writing the story.
I love how they try to pander to the idiocy of humans versus the smart side of humans. Like, we know what you're doing. We're not stupid.
Yeah.
It's funny because it brings me back to, I remember being in a Shakespeare play. Actually, this director like reached out to me like, I want to work with you and I want you to be my Shakespeare play. And I was like, yay, let's do it. I was so excited because I love Shakespeare and they really didn't have a place for me. So I came out with, as a server, with serving trays in this all white cast.
Because they couldn't imagine where they could fit you.
No, yeah.
And if they couldn't, if they couldn't tokenize you in some way, if they couldn't like find some character that it would work to have like a sassy Southern accent, like they couldn't imagine you as just any other character.
Yeah. I was just like, oh, okay. Just bring in this food and then exit. And then I remember going to this audition and they saw that show. And after like we sat down and talked and they were just like, wow, you should really think about the Shakespeare for you. I think that you'd be really great in this role. And I was like, oh, thank you. And she goes, I just think that they did a huge disservice to you and you were misused in that Shakespeare show. And I was like, thank you. Of course, give me the job. But also it's like, representation like is so important. And so like the continuation of representing BIPOC people in these stereotypical roles is just honestly not even disappointing. What's the word I'm looking for? It's just like a smack in the face, you know?
Yeah, it's just kind of, it just keeps repeating itself and it's just so insulting to have to constantly point out the same problem and either be told that you're making a mountain out of a molehill or that you're not being grateful or that you're like misunderstanding what's actually going on. I'm curious as we're talking about this, I'm going off script here because I think that and this is also very, very much so related to what we're talking about, but I want to know your take on the Hamilton criticism and like the fact that Lin doesn't spend enough time criticizing his characters for slavery. Because to me, what's interesting about that show is like I could totally see a writer's room where they're grappling with how much the show should or shouldn't be about slavery. Because it's kind of like if we go far enough down the slavery rabbit hole, then we almost just sort of have to, that's what the show has to be about. And then we have to, then what are we doing? Are we casting white people as the slaves? And then what's the commentary we're making? Like it's all of a sudden a completely different show than the show that we're trying to make, which is a show about revolution and struggle against tyranny and like immigration and change and evolution. And like, I think the commentary that he's making by casting an entirely historically white character base with BIPOC actors is to talk about the current revolution that is still taking place and to talk about the current push that is still taking place for increased representation and increased amplification of BIPOC voices and immigrant voices. But like, also I get that people are like, you're sort of lionizing these slave-holding racist old white men from the past by dusting over their misdeeds in your script. But I wonder what your take is on that. Like, how do you feel about the casting of that show and also the content of the show?
Well, Okay. I'm going to be real. Yeah. I have yet to sit down and watch Hamilton.
Blasphemy.
I know. I'm probably like the only one who at this point has not seen Hamilton yet. I want to dedicate the right time to actually like sit down and actually take it in versus like clipping it like 20 minutes here, 30 minutes there, blah, blah, blah. But I will say, I'm always curious of who starts these conversations. Who are the ones who like put out that kind of info into the world? Because I want to like look into it. Because what I'm seeing from my community is that it is changing their lives.
Right.
They are seeing themselves in powerful positions that we have never seen ourselves in. That it doesn't have to be in a space of trauma or a space of pain or in a space of racist shit. You know, it's in a world where they get to make decisions. We get to make, we just have ultimate power. And that really does uplift you to believe, especially as an artist, but even as just a person who experiences that show, to believe that you have always had that in you. So go and do that. For it to be, and I agree, like as a person who is in the theater and the structures of trying to focus a story, if it did all the different kinds of things that it could have done, it would have lost track. And it probably wouldn't have gone anywhere, you know?
Right. It would have been 8 hours long. And
I'm sure if it was really, really good, people would sit their asses down and watch it. But like, also if you had a discussion about it afterwards, what would people say? What would their experience be? And I feel like, yeah, theater is interpreted in many different ways, but there's usually a core of what the story is trying to say. And I think if it tries to do all the things, and the story and the intention will get lost.
Well, and also like to basically fight for the idea that once again, you have a show that has a predominantly BIPOC cast, and that one of the main themes in the show needs to be slavery, where it's like, that's kind of the,
right.
That's kind of like the thing that we're trying to get away from is like, and yes, it is mentioned, it is talked about in the show, but it's also like, I think exactly what you just said, like the characters that are being portrayed are eloquent, intelligent movers and shakers who are in the process of crafting a new world, a world that is under construction, that is incomplete, that is imperfect, that won't be perfected in our lifetime, let alone theirs. But these are these mammoth figures from white history and just from American history being recontextualized as people who are so silver-tongued that they spit hot fire and they debate in rap battles where they're saying 20 words per second, you know, like, or I think there was something where it said like at the fastest moments of the show, there's like, it clips along at about 6 words per second. And there's like so much verbiage in this show that if it were going at the rate that a normal musical goes at, it would be about 6 hours long. And like people have done all these analyses where I'm like that. And like, I love that it's on Disney Plus, and I love that little girls and boys are going to grow up seeing themselves in this way. And not in just the context of a show that's talking about some kind of racial struggle from the past, which not to say that that's not important content, that like content like Selma and content like When They See Us and content like that, not to say at all that that's not important content, but like to create new ways in which people can be seen and can be heard, and which the story of revolution and immigration can be heard, and not have it only contextualized under the ugly cloud of racism. I don't know. I have a hunch. I'm glad to hear you talk about it in that way, because I have a hunch that a lot of this criticism comes from well-meaning white activists who are speaking on behalf of a perceived offense.
Yes. I mean, I would not doubt that that is probably possible. And that's why I'm like, I need to look into this, because
exactly.
I'm like, have they talked with, a black person,
right,
or like anyone who's not white who has seen the show and what their experience was like. And I feel like, I mean, I see it so often where people try to speak on behalf of me and my experience. And I'm like, I don't need you to do that for me. Like, it's so, even with good intentions, you gotta be aware of why you're doing what you're doing, mm-hmm. you know? So, I'm stoked, you know, I mean, the only thing that I was like, nervous about Hamilton, it has nothing to do with Hamilton. It's exactly, kind of what we're talking about, is how people are going to take the show and how it's going to become this hit, which it did, and how it's going to become this trendy kind of cool thing for a hot second, which it did.
Right.
But other than that, like, I'm pretty stoked about it. I've had friends in Hamilton, and they said it was like some of the best experiences that they've had in the theater.
Yeah.
You know? So we need more of that, you know?
Yeah, I think it's pretty awesome that, like, the best living and working Broadway composer is an immigrant from Puerto Rico who's just creating so many opportunities for people that didn't exist previously. And it's crazy that it's such a novelty that, like, you go through the history of American musical theater and it's like, there's just not a lot of composers and lyricists who aren't white.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
And that needs to change. They're out, we're out there. We're yep. out here. You know, give us now with this new opportunity to want to pause and reshape. There's nothing but time, and the hinges need to be taken off of those doors, and let's start developing that work, because it's there. The playwrights are there. The creators are there. So let's bring them in and let's give them a safe space so they can create.
And that leads perfectly into the next thing I wanted to talk to you about, because there's another thing in this this sort of decree, this manifesto, The Ground We Stand On, talking about increased representation, not just on stage where we're visible and where the audience can see us and where your board can see us, but backstage with designers and producers and directors and choreographers and playwrights and composers and lyricists, because that is where we are sorely lacking. And just like, what is that about? Like, what, like, because I think that, again, my fragile white knee-jerk response could just be like, well, maybe there's just not that many black designers out there. Maybe there's just not that many, like, Latino, like, composers. I don't know. Like, maybe there's just not that many, you know, I don't know. Like, I don't see why they wouldn't be allowed access into the regional theater circuit with their play if their play was good enough. But, like, holy smokes, do we not see enough plays written by BIPOC people, like, yeah. and musicals written by people in that community and directed and choreographed and designed by them. Like, I just think about my history in theater and I'm like, my God, like, I think that the theater's done a nice job of employing women in positions of power in a lot of my experience. Like, I've worked with a lot of female directors and female dramaturgs and female designers and female, but so that's nice, but it's still mm-hmm. just overwhelmingly white. It's very white.
Yes. Well, I feel like I was reading, going through the demands, and I was like, yep, yep, yep. And I mean, like I said, education just keeps popping up for me. Internships, you know, I feel like in theaters, they create these opportunities to basically nurture white creatives. Mm-hmm. So like designers, choreographers, all those things,
yeah.
especially internships.
Yeah.
And internships, which aren't paid, which I'm glad that they pointed that out to be like, that needs to stop and it needs to be a paid position, because most BIPOC people cannot do internships. Like, you literally have to come from a very privileged background to be able to take an internship,
right.
you know, like that's unbelievable to work for people for free to just get one, a relationship developed with this creative person in the theater. And then two, like, get your name out there and all those things. So it starts to open doors for you. Like, that's impossible for BIPOC community to do that.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's highly the responsibility of those theaters to go and do outreach, get to know, like, we've been here. We've been ready. We've been ready for a long time. So it's time for them to do the work and go out and start building those relationships with BIPOC creators and creatives. Because we're out here. There's designers, hair designers, makeup designers, choreographers, directors, producers. Like, we've been out here for a long time. So it's time for those theaters to, like, get over their unconscious bias or their conscious bias and start doing work and getting to know the BIPOC community that's out there. You know, it's up to them. We've been here. We've been literally doing it in a very respectful, professional way for such a long time, and it hasn't got us anywhere except staying outside of the door.
Yeah.
Now it's time for them to come to our doors and talk to us. You know, that's how I feel.
And it's like, if not now, when? Like, this is like such an opportunity. This is such a moment of opportunity to do some shifting and some soul searching and some reevaluating. In this moment where we've been granted a pause, where it's like, I think so many theaters too, like, the reason why business as usual is kind of the modus operandi is because so many theaters just struggle to stay afloat as it is. And so it's like the idea of ever doing anything too radical or shifting in any way that's too new is very scary to their survival, and threatening to what if it doesn't work and we go under? Like, we're barely staying afloat as it is, but it's like right now in this moment where everyone's had to stop. Again, all responsible theaters have had to stop producing theater. It's a great opportunity to do some reevaluating. There seems to be in there with what you were talking about with internships being something that are hard to come by and available to privileged people and like that not everyone has access to. There seems to be in all of this in the theater a sort of class divide as well and a exclusion based on class. And I wonder what we can do moving forward about our model to make it more affordable and make it more accessible financially and not keep it this kind of upper class exclusionary delicacy in the arts because it's crazy because, and I sent this to you, but like the numbers for theater and the model that it has, it's just insane. Hamilton was produced on a $12.5 million budget. It's been running for what, like 6 years in like five cities and a national tour. It is never not sold out. You can't get a ticket for cheaper than $200. I think most tickets run between $300 and $500. I will never in my life pay more than $100 to go see a piece of theater, ever. So I just won't. And that's why I never saw it. I don't care how good it is. But running sold out, where most people are paying $350, $400 for a ticket, it has grossed $650 million over that six-year span. It's amazing. It's great numbers. But you look at movies, which charge, you know, $10 to $15 for a ticket, and Avengers Endgame made $2.8 billion in a few months. You know, and so it's like, how do we amend the ticket price without bankrupting the industry? Because theater struggles to make money.
Right. Kyle, I've thought about this for years, and I don't even want to claim that I have an answer because I think it's something that we're just going to have to keep reassessing. I think that theaters get comfortable. That might be maybe a harsh word. I have no idea, but I feel like they get comfortable doing the bare minimum.
Right.
You know, like, we do matinees for students. Like, hey, look, we're trying to mold the future.
Yeah.
But like, what tier are these students from? Are they really from like low income families, or what, like, really, what is it? You know, what kind of outreach is happening? Is there possibilities in the grant money that you receive from the state? Can any of that proportions go towards possibly families that can't afford to go to the theater, or those who don't have the financial means to come to the theater or experience their first theater show. Like, there's got to be some outside of the box creative thinking in regards to, like, do we always have to do those crazy Les Mis musicals all the time with the big spectacle stuff? You know, like, there are so many other great, powerful stories that can bring in the audience that maybe that we would spend on this huge spectacle show. Maybe take that proportion of that money and put it towards back into the community so you can bring in people to the theater. Mm. I don't know, stuff like that where I'm like, why do we have to be so small-minded when we're literally in an imaginative world all the time, you know? And I get that we have to be business savvy, but there's got to be other ways that we can approach it versus this old kind of same way that all the businesses run all over the world or whatever. I mean, I'm not a business person, but it's stuff like that where I'm like, can we reassess certain seasons and go about it in a different way to maybe put money in like building a relationship with a community that you're in, you know?
Right. Cause it seems like, yeah, it's just some restructuring of the budget. Cause I think the old idea is the more money you put into the show, the more money you're going to get out of it. Like, so just these big budget, you know, cast of 25 with just these epic musicals, those are the ones that sell. But it's like, but also they cost you so much money. So like, you have to look at kind of your cost versus profit. And yeah, maybe the idea is to, and I think a lot of theaters have been doing this too, like going down to like mostly four-person shows and stuff like that. But still, it's like, I like your thinking of just like, we're still so boring though, and we still always do the bare minimum, and we're still so afraid of like being more radical with our choices and being more exploratory, which is like the opposite of what inspires people to make theater in the first place.
Right.
Like, the things that got me into theater were like radical kick-ass like punk rock theater that I saw when I was in college at ACTF, or like, you know, like the stuff that like really makes me feel like, oh my God, that's what I want to do. I want to blow people's hair back. I want to give people an experience they didn't know they were capable of having. You know, right. I want to change people's idea of what a musical is. And that's kind of like what Lin-Manuel does, is like, for all these old stuffy white people who have been going to Broadway for years and years and years, he sort of revolutionizes the idea of what a musical is to them. And he also kind of like changes their idea about hip hop music in general and about their ability to consume it. And I don't know. I think that, yeah, if you can get a little creative and get and try to like, try to blow your audience away a little bit, you know, try to, instead of giving them what you think they want, give them the thing that you think is going to knock, like really surprise them. And
well, and that's the thing. Like, I feel like the theater now caters to their audience so much that literally they put themselves in a corner and up against a wall, you know? And I'm like, you don't know what your audience actually needs or wants until you actually go and start expanding their mind.
Yeah, your audience doesn't know what they need or want. Doing picking your season off of audience surveys is like, okay, cool, you're asking them what they want, but like, they're idiots, they don't know. And it's not that they're idiots, it's just they're not theater professionals. Like, they're not like professional artists whose job it is to create top tier content. So like, don't ask them what they want to see. Like, you're the person who's supposed to be the pro at making this stuff.
Right.
Make dope shit and blow people away, you know?
Right. Because I'm like, literally, if I have to see another Joseph, if I have to see another, I don't know, Mary Poppins is now everywhere. If I have to see another Les Mis, like, I'm just like, y'all, we've done it. It's been done. Unless I see something where it has some kind of cool concept and there's like actually diversity happening and stuff, then I ain't going, because I'm not going to waste my time seeing the same story told the same exact way with the same people that give the same performance. Like, it's just, it's like, what are we in a madhouse now in the theater instead of actually just being, you know, like, stop. It's not risky to be safe.
Right.
You know, so like, blow people's minds away. That's what got me into theater too, is like seeing an interpretation of a piece that I never thought that I would see before. And I left sobbing and wanting to talk to people about it and be like, did you have the same experience as I did? And if they didn't, let's talk about what you experienced. Like it, but it made me want to be not only like a better storyteller and a better actor, but just view the world in a more creative kind of way.
Right.
You know, versus just, you know, how we're told to see the world, get up, go to work, come home, eat shit, like sleep, you know, it's just, it's so boring.
Right. I mean, I think about like Do the Right Thing by Spike Lee and stuff where like the thing that was exciting about him, I think as a young filmmaker was it all went against convention. All of his choices to break the fourth wall and do direct address and then do things like that, just even like from the opening of the title sequence with Rosie Perez dancing and like that, like you're just, you know, you're watching something that's coming from a specific point of view that's also not something you've seen before. And that's right. What made it so revolutionary and made him such a legend. But it's also like if he had gone by the rule book, and by what you're supposed to do, if he had like taken a film course and like adhered to film theory and used all the correct structural tools that were available at that time, it wouldn't have been the film that it was. And what made it the film that it was and what made him the filmmaker that he is his willingness to break with convention and his willingness to risk.
Yeah, and yeah. To play by his own rules, you mm-hmm. know, like it's kind of like I was trying to think of anything that kind of did that for me recently, that like in the theater that excites me, like a Spike Lee person, kind of mentality. And there's only two musicals, and I can't recall any plays right now that have really made me kind of go, I want to see that or I want to read that. Actually, no, I lied. There's three. I lied. There is a play.
All right.
There is a play.
Yeah.
And there's Hadestown, which I was like, what is this show? This sounds so exciting to me and interesting. Hamilton, of course.
Yeah.
And Straight Play are the three things that are on Broadway that I'm like, yeah, what are they doing?
What's Straight
going on
Play?
There? Straight Play, I'm trying to remember who the playwright is. I have the play. Hold, please.
Yeah.
It was on Broadway. It was like a short run. And it literally, I can't ruin it because people should just read it. It's by Jeremy O. Harris.
Uh-huh.
And I just think that people should read it because there's so much shit that happens in it that if I give anything away, that it will ruin the play. But I will say that it's in regards to race and relationships. So read it.
Amazing.
So
I'm going to look it up.
Played by Jeremy O. Harris.
Last thing. Is there anything that we haven't covered here that you personally would hope to see as we eventually move closer to safely reopening theaters and heading back into production?
That we haven't talked about. I mean, I also, I guess I'm hoping that not only, I just wish that theaters and just people would honestly take the time to really reassess what their purpose is in it and what the outcome of what they want to see happen. And honestly, just take that time because I think rushing back into it, like I get wanting to perform. I miss it. Like what performer doesn't miss it? But I'm like, I also really appreciate the opportunity. I sound like such an actor.
I'm thankful.
I'm so grateful that this whole world is shit. I'm grateful that I stopped myself from going down the rabbit hole of wanting to just like, okay, I'm going to create this. I'm going to do this. Instead of actually going like, what am I doing? And what is my place in this theater world as a creator and as an actor or what have you. And I mean, I feel like all of us have to really reassess the systematic racism that we were born into and how we have been players in that play as well before we even can try to get back on stage, to be honest. Like it just needs to really honestly, there needs to be serious conversation, not only on the grand scale, but in those inner circles as well, because shit is happening even in the inner circles, in our own community, in the BIPOC community, that we also need to discuss, you know? And so we can do the best kind of creative work that we can do as well, you know? If that makes any sense.
Heard that and agreed. It makes perfect sense. And I really am actually quite moved. I'm kind of like, yeah, no, actually, like, for real. Not just talking about it on a podcast, not just making posts about it on social media, not just saying, yeah, we should do that. For real doing it. For real, like, how about now? Because what the fuck else are we doing?
So, seriously.
Yeah. I like it. I like it. And let's do it.
Let's do it. Let's make it permanent.
Well, all right, there it is. Sorry that ending was so weird. It was kind of abrupt, right? Yeah, what happened was, I mean, normally I try to give the conversations a little button so I can cut it off in the editing process and it sounds nice and it sounds like we really wrapped it up. But what happened was we were done talking, but I wanted to say hi to her boyfriend Tyson, who was in the room. And I said, "Is Tyson over there?" And then we started talking to Tyson, and I forgot to give the conversation a final point before I moved into talking to Tyson, which meant that I didn't get to thank her while we were recording. I stopped recording, but I did let her know that I was just so grateful that she was willing to come and talk to me about this, because I do recognize that when I'm asking my BIPOC friends to come on my show and explain these concepts for my largely white audience, that they're doing emotional labor for me that they don't owe me. And I really do appreciate them coming on to lend that perspective. It really means a lot to me that they take the time and that LaToya took the time. Isn't she great? Isn't she awesome? She's awesome. And she's one of the most talented actors working in the Salt Lake theater scene. Anyone who is a patron of that scene or just a participant in that scene knows that I'm not just blowing smoke when I say that. She is fierce. Yeah, cool. It was great talking with her. I hope that you got something out of that. I always get something out of those conversations. And yeah, you know, People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can hear more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or by looking up Austin Archer wherever you stream your tunes. I just put out a new single called Sweet Rejection. It's streaming everywhere right now. It's mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music. Marmalade Music also mixes and masters this show. They do all my stuff. You can use Marmalade Music for your project. They're an audio engineering company that's ready to take your audio project to the next level. You go to marmalademusicslc.com. You tell them, "Hey, I'm a big fan of People Pleaser, and I just heard about you through People Pleaser." And Chris is going to go, "Oh, you listen to People Pleaser? That means you get 20% off my regular rate. So how cool is that?" It's really cool. And you should go do that, because Chris is awesome, and he's my best friend, okay? But that's not why I'm saying this. I'm saying this because he really, 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 really is good at what he does. And I love him very much, and I love you for listening to the show. And that's all I have to say today. Okay, thanks for coming. See you next week. Bye-bye.